Let me just mention, too, in opposition to this, that what's going on, of course, we don't really have time to read the whole passage to you. When they say that it was taken over by force, that is literally true. VRL Trefa and essentially a gang of ex-Green Shirt and Iron Guard as stormtroopers literally came to the Vatra, the Romanian Orthodox Church, the center, and literally dragged the priests out, beat them up, broke legs and arms, and literally took the place by force. Now, bear this in mind, because this was later received official sanction in the United States as a way to transfer power of a bishop, because supposedly the other bishop was appointed by a communist church. Bear this in mind, especially because, as we mentioned earlier, parallels to Central and South America, that currently people like Archbishop Oscar Romero have been shot dead in El Salvador for siding with the poor people, and priests and nuns and others are being shot dead all over Central and South America for going against the powers that be.
Okay, now we're going to be talking about that again some more in the next broadcast of Radio Free America, which we're going to talk specifically about the Galen organization, okay? Returning again to Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. As a bishop and a fierce anti-communist who had fled his native land supposedly to escape red oppression, Trefa moved in influential circles throughout Cold War America. He made broadcasts over Radio Free Europe to Romania, broadcasts he bragged were arranged, quote, by my good friend J. Edgar Hoover, unquote. He sat on daises with the governor of Michigan, and his picture appeared in newspapers shaking hands with a smiling Hubert Humphrey. On Wednesday, May 11th, 1955, Bishop Trefa had the honor of offering the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. Quote, Almighty God, who has made America trustee of priceless human liberty and dignity, look down from heaven upon thy servants now present before thee and bless them, that they may remember in their discussions and decisions Romania and all the oppressed nations who are still longing for, quote, a government of, by the people and for the people, unquote. Bishop Trefa's presence had been requested by Vice President Richard M. Nixon. Keep in mind here that Richard M. Nixon could have selected any clergyman in the country to give the opening convocation before the U.S. Senate. He selected Bishop Trefa. Keep in mind that Trefa also associated with his opponent in the 1968 election, Hubert Humphrey. Okay? Continuing with Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. At the time, Kramer said, if I had been in the country, they never would have let Trefa into the Senate or on Radio Free Europe, unquote. But years later, after the revelations of contemporary history, the dentist had become more cynical. He now believed Hoover had been aware of Trefa's past, but in the interests of anti-communism, was willing to make a practical alliance with an Iron Guard commandant. Just as the newly formed CIA quickly and expediently forgot past grudges to draft Nazi spy chief Reinhard Galen's agents, Hoover could have sought out and protected Trefa. Significantly, Kramer was to learn, following the collapse of the Antonescu regime in 1945, Antonescu being the fascist head of state of fascist Romania, Trefa worked in Vienna as an agent for Galen's spy network. Also, Kramer decided it was no political accident that Richard Nixon invited Trefa to the Senate. It seemed more than coincidental that Richard Nixon had a rather incriminating history of involvement with another Iron Guardist who had also immigrated to America, Nikolai Malaksa. Pausing here very briefly, notice the work that Trefa does for Reinhard Galen. Notice his alleged association with J. Edgar Hoover and quite possible association with J. Edgar Hoover, the same J. Edgar Hoover who worked with the Nazi Interpol, the same J. Edgar Hoover who was very active in aiding Chambers' allegations against Alger Hiss. And notice also that Richard Nixon, Hiss's gadfly in the House Un-American Activities Committee, is also an associate here of Bishop Trefa's, invites him to give the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. And as we've seen here, that Richard Nixon was also associated with Nikolai Malaksa, who is the financier of the Romanian Iron Guard movement.
Now, damning as Richard Nixon's participation with VRL Trefa might seem, it pales into insignificance when held up against his activities on behalf of Nikolai Malaksa. Nikolai Malaksa, as Dave mentioned, was the chief contributor to the Iron Guard. He was the wealthiest man in Romania. And as we'll see, he made some very important and influential friends, both during and after World War II. Reading again from Howard Bloom's Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. During the 1930s, Maloxa had perceptively invested a sizable loan from the Romanian government intended for his locomotive factories into other industries. By 1939, he had purchased controlling interests in numerous steel, rubber, munition, and artillery factories. Maloxa had seen the future of Europe and had realized the next decade's profits were to be earned from guns, not butter. Maloxa, though, was not just a businessman. He also was a political force in Romanian politics, an agent who actively worked and conspired with the Nazis and the Iron Guard. From his factories, Maloxa hoped, would come the weapons which would win the new order. In 1936, Maloxa went to Berlin to meet with Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, and the two men parted as business partners. This personal agreement became formalized in the 1940 Volstadt Pact, which integrated Maloxa's industries with Germany's. Directing this new Nazi industrial coalition were Nikolai Maloxa and Albert Göring, younger brother of the Reichsmarshal.
Okay, now, keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not only the financier of the Iron Guard movement, but a business partner of not only Hermann Göring, but a fellow who was actually who would sign the contract with Albert Göring, his younger brother. Returning again to Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America by Howard Bloom, BLUM. On September 29, 1946, Maloxa arrived in New York as part of a Romanian government trade mission. He was never to return to Europe. In 1948, Maloxa formally applied for permanent residence in the United States, appealing for admission under the Displaced Persons Act. For the next 10 years, Maloxa was to fight a legal battle to remain in America, the best legal battle his money could buy. Maloxa's first step was to claim millions of dollars which had been deposited before the war in the Chase National Bank in the name of one of his corporations. These funds had been frozen as enemy assets during the war by John Peel, P-E-H-L-E, of the Treasury Department. Normally, such funds are used for post-war compensation to American companies, such as Standard Oil, which had property confiscated by Romania. However, John Peel had since returned to private practice, and Maloxa shrewdly hired the law firm of Peel and Loesser, L-O-E-S-S-E-R, to argue his case. This time, Peel and Maloxa won. Similarly, Ugo Carusi, C-A-R-U-S-I, was United States Immigration Commissioner when Maloxa first attempted to enter as a displaced person. When Carusi resigned his job, Maloxa hired him. Other former government officials and their associates were recruited and compensated to assist in Maloxa's legal suits. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles' law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, former Air Force Secretary Thomas K. Finletter's law firm, and the firm of former Undersecretary of State Adolph A. Burley, Jr., who personally testified on Maloxa's behalf before a congressional subcommittee on immigration. The briefs of these lawyers, though, were no match for the vivid eyewitness testimony detailing Iron Guard atrocities which were heard at every immigration hearing. A victim of justice, Maloxa tried instead privilege. At Maloxa's urging, the junior senator from California, Richard Nixon, introduced a private bill in 1951 which would allow Maloxa to remain permanently in the United States. Congressman Emanuel Seller, head of the House Immigration Committee, later said on television, quote, "I saw something suspicious about the bill. I held up the bill. The bill was never passed," unquote. The bill was defeated, but it was not the end of Nixon's involvement with Maloxa. Interrupting here to go back over some of the connections of some of the people here who are aiding Maloxa. First of all, the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, whose senior partners were not only Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, but also CIA Director Alan Dulles, as we've previously seen, both men worked hand in glove with the Galen organization. John Foster Dulles was the primary exponent of the rollback theory of communism. Recall that Sullivan and Cromwell had very profound Nazi industrial connections itself. Sullivan and Cromwell handled the business for I.G. Farben's American subsidiary. They also handled the amid the legal work for the American, for the reparations loans that were given to the Schroeder Banking Corporation, the Schroeder Industrial Empire in Germany, which Kurt Schroeder was a very powerful Nazi industrialist and financier who not only had an international banking empire in Britain, Germany, and the United States, but also was the overseer of ITT's many interests in Germany, which included the Focke Wulf aircraft manufacturer, which manufactured one of Hitler's top combat aircraft. And so there are many, many connections of Sullivan and Cromwell. Notice also that Adolph A. Burley Jr., the very same Adolph Burley Jr. who's powwowing with Whitaker Chambers about Alger Hiss in 1938, the very same Adolph Burley who's powwowing with J. Edgar Hoover and helping to standardize American and German passports with Interpol, the very same Nazi-dominated Interpol, which was headed by Reinhard Heydrich, and of course Nazi Germany had been bombing Britain. He not only did his law firm help represent Malaxa, but Burley personally testified for Malaxa. And of course, Richard Nixon introduces a bill to help allow Malaxa to stay in the country. And as indicated there, that was by no means the end of Nixon's activities on behalf of Malaxa. Keep in mind that Nixon was Hiss's primary accuser in the House on American Activities Committee.
Continuing on, it says, the Romanian, meaning Malaxa, or one of his lawyers or advisors, now had a new scheme. In May 1951, at the height of the Korean War, when all industry was under wartime control, Malaxa organized the Western Tube Corporation. The company, of which Malaxa was treasurer and sole stock owner, $1,000 worth, planned to manufacture seamless tubes for oil refining. Let me go back and point that out to you real quickly. Okay, during the Korean War panic, all industry under wartime control, Malaxa organizes the Western Tube Corporation. He is sole stock owner to the tune of $1,000. What we're talking about is a dummy company. $1,000 worth of stock is nothing, and he was the sole stock owner. Although most similar manufacturing was done in the East, Malaxa's plan was to construct facilities on the West Coast near the California oil fields. It had taken Malaxa 5 years in the United States to locate what he insisted was the perfect site for new industry, a small suburb east of Los Angeles, Whittier, California. And for Malaxa's purposes, the site was perfect. It was, coincidentally, the hometown of the then junior senator from California, Richard Nixon. This was, for Malaxa's purposes, just the first of many perfect coincidences. Western Tube's California address was 607 Bank of America Building, Whittier. This was the same address as that of the law firm of Bewley, Krupp, and Nixon. Throughout his Senate career, Nixon's name remained part of the official firm title, and Nixon used the office on his vacations in California. Thomas Bewley, Nixon's longtime friend and law partner, was secretary of Western Tube, Malaxa's dummy company. Herman L. Perry, the vice president of Western Tube, was an old Nixon political supporter, the same, quote, family friend whom Pat Nixon credited as the man who, quote, got Dick to oppose Congressman Jerry Voorhees.
Now, keep in mind, the same Jerry Voorhees, who was one of the prime congressional opponents of I.G. Farben and was working very hard to break up I.G. Farben. His stay in Congress was removed by Richard Nixon.
Indeed. On May 17, 1951, the Western Tube Corporation filed for, quote, a certificate of necessity to give top wartime priority to its materials and personnel. Also, the company filed a petition seeking first preference quota for its treasurer, Nikolai Malaxa, on the grounds that he was indispensable to the operation of Western Tube. These two applications were personally promoted by Senator Nixon. Nixon telephoned the executive assistant to INS, Commissioner James Hennessy, to plead for Malaxa's permanent entry, and a letter sent by Nixon to the Defense Production Administrator marked urgent insisted, quote, it is important strategically and economically, both for California and the entire United States, that a plant for the manufacture of seamless tubing for oil wells be erected. Urge that every consideration it may merit be given to the pending application. Bear in mind, again, this is a company that has front capital of $1,000, and all of the partners are members of Richard Nixon's law firm and personal friend circle of friends. Both appeals were successful. The application for Western Tube was quickly approved, and on September 26, 1953, Malaxa was admitted from Canada under a special first preference petition as a permanent resident. Yet, once Malaxa obtained permanent residence in the United States, nothing further was ever done to make Western Tube a reality. Neither Malaxa, nor Nixon, nor any of the corporation's other sponsors ever again concerned themselves with Western Tube. Congressman John Shelley of California was later to observe, quote, "It is impossible to discover any reasons for creating Western Tube and seeking a certificate of necessity other than to give Malaxa a springboard for entry into the United States."
This while Hiss's case, while Alger Hiss is being convicted of his communist sympathies in a court of law. Okay, so again, keep in mind, Chambers' Nazi sympathies, Hoover's Nazi sympathies, Adolf Burley's Nazi sympathies, and Richard Nixon's Nazi sympathies. Now, the name perhaps most identified with Cold War anti-communism is, of course, Senator Joe McCarthy and his infamous Senate hearings in which he destroyed many, many lives and many, many careers.
Indeed, the political milieu of which Richard Nixon was a part in the early part of his career was inextricably linked with the same political forces that shaped Joe McCarthy and which in turn he was a part of. We're going to leave off of Joe McCarthy for the time being because, again, this is a discussion of the political career of Richard Nixon, not really in order to examine Nixon as an individual human being. That is not significant. What is significant is Richard Nixon as a political animal, and indeed, the examination of Richard Nixon's political career is the examination of a political function which would have been performed by somebody had it not been performed by Richard Nixon. So the emphasis here, the importance, is to understand the political forces of which Nixon was a part and which in turn shaped him. And it is along those lines that we are conducting the examination this evening. Once again, this is going into the archives as what we're going to call Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits. And that is, in fact, a pun. And you're going to be hearing that, hearing why that's a pun in just a second. There's a very important new book, a book which I think is deeply flawed, but nonetheless very important, and one could even perhaps say essential. The book is by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. When I say Berkeley, I'm referring to the University of California at Berkeley. He's also physically located in Berkeley, at least for the time being. Professor Scott merits serious consideration as the foremost political consciousness in the United States at this time, in my opinion. And his latest work is a book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. It's published in hardcover by the University of California at Berkeley Press, and it is copyrighted 1993. In this book, Peter Dale Scott formalizes a concept which, in fact, I have been dealing with and attempting to illustrate for a long time, namely what Peter Dale Scott refers to as deep politics. The fundamental notion is that the most important concept in Peter Dale Scott's book is that a number of different events, such as the Bay of Pigs, the CIA's secret war against Fidel Castro, the assassination of President Kennedy, Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, and a great many other things, are in fact outcroppings of the same political phenomenon. That is a very valid and I think a very important political concept, and it is because of the introduction and formalization of that concept and the abundant documentation for that Peter Dale Scott provides that I think this is such an important book. I do think that there is a serious lack of reportage or a serious undercovering would be, or undercoverage would be a better way of putting it, of the Reinhard Galen World Anti-Communist League fascist milieu of which Richard Nixon and Joe McCarthy were parts and about which you have just heard. However, I do think that the Peter Dale Scott work is extremely important from a methodological as well as from an informational standpoint, and for that reason I think it belongs on every shelf. In Peter Dale Scott's Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, there are many references to Richard Nixon and the political milieu of which he was a part. One of them is contained in a section called the Martino Rosselli Retaliation Story. This deals with a fellow named John Martino, a longtime U.S. intelligence and organized crime functionary. Johnny Rosselli, a mafioso, one of the mob figures who figured prominently in the CIA's plots against Fidel Castro and in the CIA-mob collaboration. And what we're going to look at now is what Richard Nixon referred to on the Watergate tapes as, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote. And it was to cover up the whole, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, that Richard Nixon precipitated the Watergate cover-up. And as we look back on the career of Richard Nixon, we invariably alight on the Watergate scandal. And the press, in their recent discussion of the life of Richard Nixon, overlooked the central elements of what Watergate was really all about. And what Watergate was really, the real significance of Watergate was not the Watergate scandal proper or what we have seen of it, but rather the political forces at work during the course of the Watergate scandal, both in the public eye and outside of the public eye. Because indeed, Watergate itself was the outcropping of some very powerful political forces which predate Richard Nixon and which dominate the world today. Peter Dale Scott, writing in his new book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, says of the Bay of Pigs, Richard Nixon, U.S. intelligence political milieu, quote, "In 1963, out of the Bay, after the Bay of Pigs debacle and Martino's release from a Havana prison, Rosselli and Martino set up shop together in Key Biscayne to mobilize a new Cuban exile resistance to Fidel Castro. From what is known of their work in this period, they seem to have had only limited support from the CIA. Their main encouragement came rather from old Nixon contacts like William Pauley and Nathaniel Weil, W-E-Y-L, who in 1963 ghostwrote a book for Martino, quote, I was Castro's prisoner, unquote. They also worked with men from the old CIA mob alliance authorized under Nixon's and Pauley's urging." That's William Pauley, a veteran U.S. intelligencer and China lobby kingpin. Carlos Prios, by the way, beginning again. "They also worked with men from the old CIA mob alliance authorized under Nixon's and Pauley's urging. Carlos Prio Siqueiros, Tony Verona, Jerry Patrick Hemming, and Frank Sturgis. All four of these men, it should be noted, had been associated with the Lake Pontchartrain training camp, the relevance of which will become evident when we see the role of Martino in his Bayo-Pauley mission, like the training camp in the Kennedy assassination story." Well, indeed, one cannot separate out, one cannot separate Richard Nixon from the intertwining threads of the CIA's anti-Castro efforts, the Bay of Pigs, the assassination of President Kennedy, and Watergate. All of those things are directly connected, though by no means a coterminous. And in examining the life of Richard Nixon, one must take a prolonged look at, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote. Indeed, Richard Nixon was deeply involved with the intelligence organized crime milieu, which was involved with the CIA's anti-Castro efforts as well as the Bay of Pigs proper. That same milieu was a central element in the assassination of President Kennedy and later events. And in examining, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, one is not just examining political forces that are connected with Richard Nixon, but in examining, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, and it was to keep, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, from coming out that Richard Nixon precipitated the Watergate cover-up. In understanding, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, one is coming to understand or attempting to understand the history of the United States in the second half of the century, the history of American fascism, and beyond that, the history and the workings of the political forces which are ascendant in this country and in this world today. By way of memorializing Richard Nixon, and by way also of coming to understand why I am entitling this archive show Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits, we're going to examine an addendum to the Guns of November Part 3. The original Guns of November broadcast was done on the first 8th, 15th, and 22nd days of November of 1983. Once again, my collaborator was Nip Tuck, who very effectively assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. In 1992, specifically in June of 1992, I did a long addendum to the Guns of November Part 3. That addendum was by way of memorializing the 20th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. And what we're going to do now is we're going to listen to a segment, or in fact, we're going to listen to the addendum to the Guns of November Part 3. This is approximately an hour and a half in length, and we're going to listen to a long discussion of connecting links between the assassination of President Kennedy and Watergate, and indeed the Bay of Pigs milieu is inextricably linked with this. There is, of course, more information about the connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate in the original Guns of November Part 3 broadcast, that from November 15th, 1983. I'm going to begin this addendum to the Guns of November Part 3 by reading some sections from a book called The Ends of Power,
That was authored by former Nixon aide H.R. Bob, as he was known, Haldeman, H-A-L-D-E-M-A-N. And this was written with Joseph DeMona, capital D-I, capital M-O-N-A. It was copyrighted 1978 and published in hardcover in that year by New York Times Books. Now, the thing that Richard Nixon was looking to keep covered up vis-a-vis the Watergate scandal was what he referred to often as, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Richard Nixon did not want to disclose or did not want to release the Watergate tapes because he was worried that releasing the Watergate tapes and the disclosure of the scandal might, quote, blow the whole Bay of Pigs thing open. Now, in The Ends of Power, Bob Haldeman reveals that the Bay of Pigs thing, quote-unquote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, was a well-known code word in the Nixon White House for the Kennedy assassination. Or that basically was what Richard Nixon was referring to. Now, Haldeman and Joseph DeMona write in The Ends of Power, "So we had failed in our one previous attempt to obtain CIA cooperation, and now in Ehrlichman's office on June 23, 1972, the CIA was stonewalling me again. Quote, not connected, unquote. Quote, no way, unquote. Then I played Nixon's trump card. Quote, the president asked me to tell you this entire affair may be connected to the Bay of Pigs, and if it opens up, the Bay of Pigs may be blown. Turmoil in the room. Helms, that's former CIA Director Richard Helms, gripping the arms of his chair, leaning forward and shouting, quote, the Bay of Pigs had nothing to do with this. I have no concern about the Bay of Pigs, unquote. Silence. I just sat there. I was absolutely shocked by Helms' violent reaction. Again, I wondered, what was such dynamite in the Bay of Pigs story? Finally, I said, quote, I'm just following my instructions, Dick. This is what the president told me to relay to you, unquote. Skipping down. Years later, former CBS correspondent Dan Shore called me. He was seeking information concerning the FBI investigation Nixon had mounted against him in August of 1971. Shore later sent me his fascinating book, Clearing the Air. In it, I was interested to find that evidence he had gleaned while investigating the CIA finally cleared up for me the mystery of the Bay of Pigs connection in those dealings between Nixon and Helms. It's intriguing when I put Shore's facts together with mine. It seems that in all those Nixon references to the Bay of Pigs, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination. And that is interesting because that is what, according to Bob Haldeman, Nixon was worried about in connection with Watergate, that the whole Bay of Pigs thing might come out. One of the possibilities that has to be very, very seriously considered is that among the many, many losers, if the true story of President Kennedy's assassination ever came out, might indeed be Richard Nixon himself. I'm reading now from a book called, I'm going to reread from sections of a book called Coincidence or the Assassination of President Kennedy, Coincidence or a Conspiracy. This was authored by Bernard Fensterwald Jr. And he, interestingly enough, was the defense attorney for James McCord, one of the Watergate burglars and the individual who in all probability betrayed the team, as they used to refer to themselves, inside the Watergate Hotel. That, of course, was where Democratic National Party headquarters were. This book was published in softcover by Zebra Books of the Kensington Publishing Corporation, and it was copyrighted 1977. In this book, it discusses, and we talked about this in the original installment of The Guns of November, in this book, there is discussion of Richard Nixon's curious behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of John Kennedy. Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas from November 20th through November 22nd of 1963 in his role as an attorney for PepsiCo, the parent company of Pepsi-Cola. And Bernard Fensterwald writes about Richard Nixon as follows. Richard M. Nixon, who was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, left the city a couple of hours before the Kennedy assassination occurred, and he later told the FBI that he hadn't been in Dallas at all that day. Later still, Richard Nixon also gave an inaccurate accounting of when he had actually arrived in Dallas. Skipping down, during his FBI interview on February 28, 1964, Nixon inaccurately stated that he'd left Dallas on November 20th, rather than on November 22nd. An FBI report contained in Warren Commission Exhibit 1973 states the following. On February 28, 1964, the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the U.S., was contacted by Assistant Director in charge of the New York office, John F. Malone, and furnished the following information. Mr. Nixon advised that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas during 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So Richard Nixon, who of course was defeated in the 1960 presidential race by John Kennedy, when interviewed just 3 months after the assassination on February 28th of 1964, claimed that he had left Dallas, Texas on November 20th, 2 full days before he actually did. One of the truisms of the assassination of John Kennedy is that everyone who was of the age of consciousness when they heard Kennedy was killed remembers exactly where they were and what they were doing. That apparently does not include Richard Nixon. The fact that Richard Nixon's role vis-a-vis the Kennedy assassination has not received more public scrutiny than it has is all the more interesting because the New York Times of November 22, 1963 carries a UPI story, Dateline Dallas, on November 21, 1963, which quotes Richard Nixon. Now, remember that Nixon told the FBI just 3 months after the assassination that he had left Dallas, Texas on November 20th. Well, this UPI story in America's paper of record, the New York Times, quotes Nixon in Dallas a day after he claims he left, or that he claimed he left when interviewed by the FBI. This article reads, "Former Vice President Richard M. Nixon, on a business trip to a city President Kennedy visits tomorrow, said today the 1964 Republican nominee must beat Mr. Kennedy on his record, not on personalities." Quote, "His public relations is tremendous," Mr. Nixon said, "but his performance is poor." Mr. Nixon said the Republican nominee must attack Mr. Kennedy on his record of non-achievement, his, quote, "brave talk but no action," unquote, deterioration of foreign policy toward Latin America and Southeast Asia, and, quote, "what is apparently our permanent unemployment," unquote. Mr. Nixon said Mr. Kennedy's failure to handle Congress, where he has a 2-to-1 majority, quote, "shows his lack of leadership much better than anything else," unquote. He again denied that he would seek the Republican nomination, but he said, quote, "I am going to work as hard as I can to get the Kennedys out of there. We can't afford 4 more years of that kind of administration," unquote. Well, among the things that we have looked at in various archive shows, including the aforementioned Guns of November Part 3, is that President Kennedy was in the process of withdrawing the United States from Vietnam. That was one of many things that got him killed. He also was in the process of achieving a diplomatic rapprochement with Cuba. Nixon had long-standing political ties to the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, which, of course, was inextricably linked with the CIA and organized crime. So certainly a diplomatic rapprochement with Castro was not something that would have sat well with Richard Nixon. We covered that in Radio Free America program number 12 in considerable detail. Now, the question remains, why did Richard Nixon dissemble concerning his presence in Dallas on 11-22-63? Certainly he could not have left Dallas on November 20th when he was interviewed by UPI in Dallas on November 21st. A speculative but very possible account of what Nixon was doing in Dallas and why he lied about it is carried in a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. That's authored by Penn Jones, Jr., one of the best and earliest of the critics of the Warren Commission, one of the best researchers. And this was published privately by the Midlothian Mirror, or actually it was published by the Midlothian Mirror and copyrighted 1969 in soft cover. And interestingly enough, this book has an account. And by the way, Penn Jones was a journalist with the Midlothian Mirror, and that is a suburb of Dallas, Texas, and he was in a position to begin investigating the Kennedy assassination from the ground level, so to speak, almost at once. By the way, the title, a number of people have wondered where the title comes from. The title of Forgive My Grief, and there are 4 volumes in all, comes from a poem in memoriam by Alfred Lord Tennyson, a portion of which reads, Forgive my grief for one removed, thy creature whom I found so fair. I trust he lives in thee, and there I find him worthier to be loved. And interestingly enough, in Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, Penn Jones presents an account that Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were at a party by Texas oil magnate Clint Murchison, M-U-R-C-H-I-S-O-N. According to Robert Depew, the head of the Minutemen, Clint Murchison was the number one financier of the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and phone number were in Oswald's address at the time of his arrest. The speculation here by Penn Jones is that Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were at the Murchison party as part of an executive go conference on the assassination of Kennedy. In other words, the final plans for the go-ahead were made at this party, although, as he speculates, not in the presence of most of the party goers. In Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, Penn Jones writes as follows, talking about parties of wealthy Dallas society that were held at Clint Murchison's home. Penn Jones says, "An earlier unreported Murchison party was much more important than those of recent years. This party was held on the night of November 21st, 1963, at the Murchison home, and we think was the cover for an important conference of the assassination staff. We have always felt sure that before the president was killed, a staff conference was held somewhere, and all the elements of the assassination plot were present or represented. For a time, we thought the conference was held in Sykes, Louisiana. There were some planning meetings held in Sykes for some of the lower-level operatives, but not the big meeting just before the hit. When it is realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was even more important than the Normandy invasion with General Eisenhower in command, then the conference for the Dallas Project becomes essential. The killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of a country in our world history. All the major forces in this country were involved and had to be accounted for at the final conference before the strike. So a conference was necessary, and the conference was held. Since Richard M. Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murchison home that night, we feel we should report that the conference was held there in the home, not in the presence of the partygoers, to be sure, but on the premises." And skipping down, "Admittedly, our information about Hoover's presence was learned secondhand, but it is reliable. We will never tell how we got the information." Well, that obviously is a speculative account, but one which I think certainly warrants serious examination. I think we can assume that Richard Nixon was lying in his teeth when he told the FBI that he left Dallas on November 20th. There's no way that his memory could have been off by a full 48 hours within 3 months. So he was lying about something, and it seems probable that he was involved in Kennedy's assassination in some way, whether it was, as Penn Jones has speculated, at a go conference, so to speak, with J. Edgar Hoover at the home of Clint Murchison or not. It does appear that Nixon was probably involved in some way or another, as were many other people who participated in some way in the Watergate scandal. Now, in The Guns of November, Part 3, we discussed a number of connecting links between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate. First, we discussed the fact that when Spiro Agnew resigned as vice president because of numerous scandals surrounding him, he was replaced by Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was a key Warren Commission member who succeeded Richard Nixon as president and subsequently pardoned Richard Nixon for all crimes committed, not just in connection with Watergate. We also spoke about the fact that the Watergate special prosecutor, who was less than vigorous in his pursuit of many of the darker aspects of Watergate, namely Leon Jaworski, had been a key Warren Commission counsel, and beyond that, he also had been a member of the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit. We also spoke about the fact that Nixon's Attorney General John Mitchell, and we will touch back on this, was the individual who refused to disclose the spectrographic evidence concerning the various bullets fired in the assassination of John Kennedy to researchers James Lazar and Harold Weisberg. The only conceivable legal excuse for not releasing the spectrographic evidence was that if it might somehow compromise an ongoing investigation, and there was no ongoing investigation of the Kennedy assassination in those years, despite the fact that there was absolutely no legal basis for John Mitchell to attempt to withhold the information from Weisberg and Lazar. John Mitchell later was convicted in the Watergate scandal. Judge John Sirica, Maximum John Sirica, initially ruled in favor of the government and against Weisberg and Lazar, despite the fact that there was absolutely no legal basis for him doing so. Recall that the Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. It had no legal status whatsoever. It was not even part of the judicial branch of government. It was part of the executive. Many people have been confused on this because the head of this presidential fact-finding commission was former Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Earl Warren. Interestingly enough, Earl Warren, as we looked at in the Guns of November Part 3, got his start in American political life largely as a result of the boost of Murray Chotiner, an organized crime-connected attorney, who was also an individual who was deeply involved with the rise of Richard Nixon. Nixon had long-standing ties to organized crime, and his early congressional campaigns were heavily financed by Los Angeles mobster Nicky Cohen. We also looked at the fact that Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis had been, his name surfaces in connection with the Kennedy assassination. Sturgis had been the source for a spurious story that a Cuban intelligence agent named Pedro Charles was going to pay Oswald to kill President Kennedy on behalf of Fidel Castro. As we've seen, that was completely ridiculous because Castro and Kennedy, in fact, were working out a diplomatic rapprochement at the time that Kennedy was killed, and Castro was quite shocked when he heard about that. Again, we went into that in the Guns of November, or in Radio Free America program number 12. Interestingly, there was a letter produced from this supposed Pedro Charles to Lee Harvey Oswald. There was also a warning letter to the FBI warning that a Cuban intelligence agent named Pedro Charles would, in fact, would be using Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate President Kennedy. And both the warning letter and the actual supposed letter from Pedro Charles, the supposed Cuban intelligence agent, were typed on the same typewriter, as the FBI subsequently found out. Also, Gordon Novell, that's N-O-V-E-L-L, actually N-O-V-E-L, one L, a veteran U.S. intelligencer who had been involved with the Bay of Pigs operation and who was being pursued by Jim Garrison. In Jim Garrison's investigation, he was never convicted, nor has there ever been any proof that Gordon Novell was involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. But it's interesting that Gordon Novell was initially tabbed by White House counsel Charles Colson to explore the possibility of erasing the Watergate tapes using a degaussing gun. Some of those tapes do appear to have been erased. In an interview that I had with Gordon Novell, he denied having erased the Watergate tapes. I asked him whether he denied erasing the Watergate tapes. He said, quote, "only because they didn't pay me," unquote. Make of that what you will. I then pressed him, and he said, no, I didn't erase the Watergate tapes. But interestingly enough, he did reveal that he was the one member of an electronics panel that was reviewing the famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap on one of the tapes, supposedly made by Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, and he was the one member of the electronics panel who said that the erasure could have been accidental, as Woods claimed. All the others said it has to have been deliberate. Also, John Connolly, one of Nixon's Treasury secretaries and an individual who initially was convicted in the Milk Fund scandal, John Connolly had helped to frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation by refusing to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith from Texas to New Orleans. We're going to talk about Arcacha Smith later. But there are many, many connecting links between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate. We're going to go into some of those now. Again, of Attorney General John Mitchell, I should say, and his role in frustrating the Weisberg-Lazar suit. This, once again, from Coincidence or Conspiracy by Bernard Fensterwald. Bear in mind that he was James McCord's defense attorney. However, during the course of the hearing, Werdig, W-E-R-D-I-G, disclosed a new and unusual contention that took legal observers by surprise. Quote, "In this instance, the Attorney General of the United States, John Mitchell, has determined that it is not in the national interest to divulge these spectrographic analyses." Shortly thereafter, the Weisberg suit was dismissed. By the way, that analysis was of the various bullet fragments that were recovered from Kennedy's car. It might have proved that they were from different bullets, and that, in fact, might have disproved what really should not need to have been disproved, namely the so-called single bullet theory, which was absolutely ridiculous. Some of the other interesting connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate concerns the large number of Warren Commission counsels who were requisitioned by one element or another of the Nixon administration to function in one way or another in the legal defense of that administration during Watergate.